Welcome to Iteration, a weekly podcast about development and design through the lens of amazing books, chapter by chapter. Hi, I am John, and as always, I am joined by the amazing JP. How are you doing this week, JP?
Pretty good. Feels like it's been a really long time since we recorded, and I think it has been because we've just been so busy with life.
But what's the amazing reality of the magic of podcasting is that our listeners won't have skipped a beat because we had a couple ahead in the can. So this is just like back with the regular weekly pace. And so hi, guys. But yeah, I think it's been about 2 weeks since we've actually recorded, if you know the time delay and how we do that under the seat behind the scenes.
Yeah, totally. Just some life updates. I think, what was it? Wow, not last week, but the week before that, first week of October, I was in San Francisco for a week-long company-wide hackathon for Open Door, which was super, super cool. We built an app for our showing agents, all with React Native. We interfaced a little bit with our backend, had to build out like a little JWT, little Jot support, so that was kind of fun. Got very little sleep. I feel like only now, a week after that, I'm like fully recharged. But overall, it was very fun.
Oh man, that's gnarly. But I mean, that's what you get when you go to a hackathon. You're signing up for very little sleep. So, okay, give me a couple more specifics. So you went to this hackathon, which is a company-sponsored hackathon by Open Door that now owns Open Listings. That happened a few weeks ago. So this is your regular jobby job. Is like, how do they even like bring that to you? Is this an optional thing? Is this a company thing? Like, give me a little bit more setup to how you ended up on this amazing little retreat.
Cool. Yeah. We have a biannual hackathon. So they're a week long, and I think the first one happens around February. The second one happens, well, obviously October. And it's kind of a nice way to sort of take a break from all of the like Q4 things and all of like the OKRs. OKRs, for those of you that don't know, are I'm probably going to butcher this. I think it's objective key results. Yes, yeah. Yes, that's exactly what it is. Take a break from that and work on something that you wouldn't normally work on. Now, obviously, this is like, you're not going to be like, oh, for the hackathon, I'm going to work on a company jingle. it's like you're going to be working on something that may or may not actually be used, but something that ultimately you think could benefit the company, but it is your like opportunity to have a little bit of fun. So we made a mobile app. On the other hand, there were definitely some teams that were like, we're going to use machine learning and drones and AI and big data and data science and all this stuff. Basically every tech buzzword you can think of, people actually were being serious and actually came up with some really cool things. For example, someone made like an Alexa app so that like if you're touring a house, you can like, I almost said query Alexa. You can ask Alexa things about the house. And that was pretty cool. And there was like a live demo that was actually very impressive.
Wow, that's super interesting. So is there like a demo day after everybody was doing this week-long hackathon where you had to like show off what you did?
Yeah, so there's like a huge deck that is shared on Google Drive. And if you want to present, you can. I think most people do want to present just so they can show off the things they've been doing, unless you worked on something that was like banal and kind of like not really show off worthy. But yeah, that's kind of how it goes.
How many total people were there like for the demo? Is that a little nerve wracking?
Okay, so it's mostly just like the engineering teams, which is actually quite big. So a couple hundred people. So only the engineering teams kind of, or like product, sorry. So like design will take part, a little bit of project management will take part, but not like be involved. You're not like hacking 5 days of the week. Sheesh. If you're a project manager.
I guess, but I didn't realize Open Door was so much bigger than Open Listings. So you went from like a dozen or so-ish team size to like hundreds team size now?
Yeah, so Open Listings before the acquisition, I want to say we were like mid to high 40s, and the engineering team made up about a fourth of that. The engineering team at Open Door is like in the hundreds.
Wow, that's crazy. Wow. Yeah. That's a really cool experience. So have you ever done anything like a startup weekend or a hackathon before? And how did it compare to that? Like a normal, like non-company sponsored thing?
No, like never. And I was like surprised to hear that it was a whole week long. It was like, oh, we get to not do a sprint for a week. Like we literally can just forget everything for a whole week and hack on a single thing. Like that was very cool.
Were they open, like, as far as what you wanted to build and what technologies? Like, if you wanted to build something out in Vue or Dart, like, would they have cared? Is it about that kind of exploration, or is it a little bit more constrained to existing tooling and code base? Like, how productive are they expecting you to be? That's kind of what I'm asking.
Yeah, if you want to, you totally can. It just depends on, like, what you think you can ship in a week. It depends on your outlook. But if you were just like, I kind of want to learn Vue. You totally could be like, I'm going to build a blah, blah, blah in Vue. Someone built something out and they were like, oh, and I learned GraphQL along the way. So that was pretty cool.
That's really cool.
So it is sort of like a week to explore and hack on cool things. And like, it's nice. I think they mostly do it too, because it's like a break from normal work. And so it lets you recharge, even though you're still working very hard. It gives you that like mental break and lets you like recharge. Which is nice.
Yeah, lets you explore, especially twice a year. That's a pace that's like enough that you can feel like your job's not monotonous. Because sometimes development work, like you can get really in the minutia of a React component for like a week, and it can get a little shitty sometimes. Even though this job is great and what we do is awesome, but like that makes a lot of sense that you just totally get to like. There's no rules. You don't have to worry about production. You can just like hack something together. That's really cool. And I especially love it for like the team building aspect of it. Instead of going whitewater rafting with your team or, you know, doing an escape room, like it makes a ton of sense to actually like let engineering do what they love. Like, because that's what a lot of people love to do if they're in that industry, obviously. So it makes a lot of sense to like let them loose for a week and see what they can do. And that's really interesting. Do you think any of the projects will actually end up affecting like the actual business long term? Or is it more of just flexing muscles and exercising?
No, I think some of the because we were up in San Francisco, I think some of the stuff that they were working on in LA was like integration work between Open Listings and Open Door that I think ultimately will be used. I think the app we made, there's like a possibility that like in Q1 of next year, we might be able to like actually launch it, which is going to be pretty cool. But yeah, like you said, it's really cool team. But like I've never worked till 4, 5 a.m., 5:30 a.m. with coworkers before working on a project, like literally hacking until like the wee hours of the morning. I don't know. That's like an experience that I'm going to, this is so nerdy. This is like an experience that I'm going to cherish.
I'll never forget my first hackathon. It was, I think 2015 at the YouTube space. It was like a brand new YouTube space. And it was just like, I remember it being like 2 or 3 a.m. and just Red Bull on one side of me, of my laptop, and whiskey on the other side of my laptop. And just like trying to hack together this Rails app with like 4 or 5 other developers. It's such a good experience that you never forget. And you really stretch yourself and realize how much you really can accomplish with focus and that kind of deep focus into something and good collaboration. And when there's no rules, it's just like, yeah, you can just ship. It's really cool. Also probably a little unhealthy, but hey, in doses a couple times a year, it's probably good. A week though, man, that's crazy. Cause I've only done like the 48-hour hackathon thing, 72-hour. I've never done anything like a week.
Yeah. It's cool because like we would work really hard, but we would like treat ourselves, you know, relax for dinner, spend like 2-3 hours at dinner, get a couple drinks, hit that Balmer Peak, come back, work into the late hours of the night. But yeah, it's like amazing like what you said, like there's no rules. And you know, when you're in the normal everyday, I don't want to say minutia, when you're in the normal everyday, like swing of things, you might be working on a ticket or a huge feature for like a week or two. And you're not worrying about, because you should be testing. And so like you're testing things, you're, you know, making small changes, you're, you know, the feedback loop is like very, I don't know, like it takes a long time to actually ship something. But in a hackathon, you're just like busting out features, you know, and it's like, we made like a huge checklist of things on our like little Notion thing, the pick that I had a couple weeks ago. And we just had like a long laundry list of things. And it was like, all right, I'm grabbing this one. All right, I'm grabbing this one. You know, 30, 40 minutes later, it's like, hey, where's everyone at? Like, who needs help? And we just busted out like, I don't know. There must have been like 20, 25 like things on this checklist of like, here's what we need to do. and being able to just like iterate very quickly and like knock things out and like to a level of polish that was like very surprising for a hack week was like very impressive and really fun. I do.
Yeah.
10 out of 10 would do again.
That's awesome. And I saw like you sent me a little screen recording of what you guys hacked together. It was so impressive. Like I could not believe that that was put together in a week. That's really cool. But I mean, that's how far you can get when you have kind of some existing paradigms to work off of and that deep work. And you guys didn't have to do any back end, right? It was all just front end work.
The first day I spent hacking together like a JWT implementation so that we can actually talk to the API.
Got it, okay.
So yeah. Oh, one thing I shouldn't like forget to say is that we had like a designer with us too, and that helped so much. And he's like a very, very talented guy. I just feel like it's worth mentioning that like he had an equal part in like this hack. Like without him, it would have, I don't know, he's sort of like, he was like the glue to the to actually have like mocks to base our hack or like screens off of. It wasn't just like pure hacking something together, you know, there was like some cohesiveness to it.
Yeah. And he was probably a little bit the champion of the product, like making sure it was something that was kind of cohesive in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Too. He's a little bit of like project management at the same time, which is great. But yeah, I've like blabbered on for like a little too long. What's been up with you for the last 2 weeks?
No, it's awesome. I'm super glad to hear about it. I really wanted to hear all about it. I was super curious about that coming up, and it just seemed like an awesome thing. I've just been working a ton, a lot of Rails work, a lot of React Native work that gets super wonky. I've been trying to do more and more on my own, not just with other contractors. So that's been cool to kind of own more and more of that space. I think it was like 2 weeks ago when we last talked that I was like, I fully did my own React Native feature. Maybe that was three or four episodes ago. So
that's right.
Yeah, still pushing more into React Native. I really want to explore testing in React Native more because currently all my React Native code bases have absolutely zero test coverage. And just like there's been a couple deploys for me recently that kind of bit me in my ass where I was like, oh, I'm going to add this new feature, but then broke old. It's like the same thing that you start maturing in a certain framework. For me, at least, once I get to a certain point, I start reaching for the other things that I have that I know so well. Because in Rails, I have got test coverage in a lot of respects really dialed in. And I'm very confident shipping code to production and making changes, where I still feel that like scariness every time that I'm in React Native that I'm breaking existing functionality. And the reality is I probably am because I don't have that test coverage. So yeah, just a lot of work. And actually recently I had a big project come in the door that was a huge Shopify custom front end. So that's been really, really different to work with like the Liquid templates. And it was just basically a lot of vanilla JavaScript, this really, really complicated front end. And that's been an interesting but extremely challenging project for me just because it's really stretching my abilities as what I can do in JavaScript. And honestly, it's kind of stretching what you should do with vanilla JavaScript. Like we probably should have React or something on the front end handling some of this at some point. Cause like we're managing state with these custom objects and it's all just plain JS, and it's a lot. It's a lot with just plain JS, but you know, I'm loving JavaScript more and more the more that I'm using it. And, it's good. I'm getting my head around it. It's funny though, because when I work in JavaScript, I just end up creating objects like so quickly. And I just think so object oriented from Ruby, it's hard for me to break out. So speaking on the subject of Ruby and objects, I want to kind of jump into our last section of this book that we've been talking through by Advi Grimm, Exceptional Ruby. And this last section, is there like a moniker or a section title for this last section of the book? Or is it just kind of the last section?
I don't know if this is, I think there might be, oh no, there's like a section after this, but it's like a shorter section that's like not really a section. It's like a fake section.
It's not conversation worthy to me, I don't think. I mean,
this one's called Alternatives to Exceptions.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Cool.
It's kind of an exception to the exception, if you will. So this is the final section, Alternatives to Exceptions by Advi Grimm.
That sounds exceptional. Let's jump in, shall we?
Yeah, let's jump in. Yeah, totally. The first topic of this of the last part of this little PDF reader is about failing fast, and there are exceptions to when you should fail fast. So, for example, if you're running a test suite, if one of your tests break for whatever reason, and because there was like an exception that should have been like handled, you don't want like the whole test suite to stop, especially if you're in something like a mini test, or I'm sure every testing test runner test framework is like this. Your tests probably don't run in the same order every time. Ideally, you want your tests to be not order dependent so that they can run in any order and you can reliably ship your code and all that good stuff. So that's like an example of when you don't want your test, or when you don't want something to fail fast. Whereas in an app, if something fails, like you probably want to surface that error and bubble it all the way up to the user and not like continue passing around like malformed data, for example. So sometimes you need to tell your system like, hey, if something fails, we need to handle that and not blow up the entire thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it made a point there too in that section that you can't fail so aggressively that you don't capture the diagnostics. So if you're using something like, you know, AppSignal, Rollbar, we've mentioned these things in the past. But if you're using something like that, you want to be careful that your rescue or begin, all these different clauses that you're structuring your exception handling aren't structured in a way that bypasses any of that. And that's the last thing you want, is to not know when a failure is happening on the front end. And like that, to me, that's the big missing piece of between the tests that you're running locally and between deployment in the real world, having a consistent and powerful diagnostics tool tracking your performance and errors is so, so important. And it's like the big missing piece in that whole puzzle of handling exceptions and creating sustainable, just maintainable systems overall.
Totally. Yeah. So there's like, I guess these are like techniques of like things you can do instead of failing right away. And one of them was like having multiple return values. So what you can do is Ruby lets you, like if you return an array, you can actually like splat the values out of that array. If you're like familiar with JavaScript, this is sort of like destructuring. So if in JavaScript, if you return an object, you can like destructure key, like the key value pairs out of that return. In the same way you can do that in Ruby, you can return an array and then like assign the things that you're splatting out of the array. I don't know. That sounds very weird to say out loud.
No, I've got it. I'm tracking with you. It makes a lot of sense. And I think in that case, it's you can have different data that may be relevant to the error catch situation.
Right.
Yeah. So you can pass more than just one thing.
Yeah. So there's like a little example of like, let's say you have a result variable and you have like a success variable that points to like a Boolean. You can return this. You can return like the result and like success. And after you call that method, you can like destructure result and success. And then based on what those are, you can display some UI, whether that's like it's a command line app, or if it's like a web app, or if it's like an API call, whatever. Whatever the user interface happens to be, that is like a mechanism to not fail fast and like raise an exception. Like you don't need an exception. You can just like pass an error message to the user that says, hey, something went wrong.
This is really useful when you need something a little bit more powerful than the standard error handling that's kind of built. Specifically, I'm talking about in Rails. Like you have the E dot and some methods on there, but if you want to pass more of that data, like let's say there's a complex request being sent up to an API, you could pass that request back on failure if you wanted to. So there's a lot. This is a really useful tool if you think about keeping in the back of your head, like overriding and creating your own basically object or array that you can pass on an error state that has multiple attributes to it. And, you know, maybe you're doing things like, okay, spitting back the original request array, so you have that to display in the view, but then also grabbing, you know, the array of errors coming back and assigning them to different places and then throwing them back. And I love in your notes, you actually have an example of it using an OpenStruct in Ruby, which is basically just creating a new object. So instead of just having an array with items, you kind of have to parse and figure out what they mean. You can actually have a queryable object-like thing that you can interact with, which is a really interesting approach. And I think for that use case would work really, really well.
Yeah, I think I touched on this a little bit too in a previous talk about how I do something similar in like a Redux application where you're making API calls in your actions and let's say the API call fails, you get like a 401 unauthorized or like a 500 internal server error. Like the React app shouldn't break. Like, you should just surface an error message. And so, like, you're passing just back an object that has, like, the same shape in the same way that you would edit, like, the E dot, like, the error dot messages in Ruby. Mm-hmm. Like, you would do something very similar in JavaScript. It's all the same stuff, man. A lot of this stuff is just, like, the same shit.
It's totally true when you say that. I feel like more and more applying things, lessons learned from Ruby or Pragmatic Programmer, all the stuff we've talked through, every type of code I find myself in, even if it's just like CSS or HTML, just markup even, a lot of the like that tools that we've learned and those tips over time really apply themselves and lend themselves well across different things. A funny example actually is, and I didn't even write the code, but in doing a code review today, I realized that one of my contractors totally picked up on the idea of separating out, I forgot exactly what Pragmatic Programmer called this, but it was about having a config file to do more things. So like they're in two different places. So you're separating out kind of the data in within a system into its own config file. And like it was this whole really complex settings view. And it would have just been this big HTML ERB template that had all these different settings. But it really is just like this whole index view of a bunch of different settings. And so what he did is he extracted a settings view helper. And so there's this really nice JSON-like object that you can just edit. And in the view, there's just a single list item that it iterates over these different settings. And it's like, it worked so well and it was so elegant and so easy to update and understand what was going on. I was just like, this is just like that tip. Like it doesn't directly apply to it, but it's the kind of same concept. And I did something similar in this JavaScript work that I'm doing for the Shopify site, like just iterating over the different elements on the JavaScript instead of having it all in the DOM and just making it so messy. And it's just so much cleaner way to think about things. But that was a big rat hole. So back to the different types of outputs you can have in error states. Also say is a lot of these tips are, you can just apply to so many different frameworks and libraries. And there's, and more and more that I'm like not afraid of a new framework or library, the more I'm able to learn from it and bring it back to the other ones that I do go deeper on, which is mm-hmm. really cool to do. So yeah, the other one is kind of output parameters. So this is the caller supplied fallback strategy, which is what the book was recommending. So we're talking about how you can error and you can pass some different things forward to it. This is the other one where, you know, when you're calling it, you can specify what you want to get back. That's kind of what it's recommending, right? In this caller supplied fallback strategy. Is that kind of right? You made this note, so I'm not sure after I said it.
No, I was hoping you would pick up on it because I'm reading this now and I'm like, oh, wow, I'm not quite sure what this is. So basically, okay, yeah, so these are alternatives to exceptions, right? But we are actually like throwing, we actually are rescuing and passing an error to what they're calling like a failure policy. So this is like a policy object, if you will. In this example that I have here in front of us, it's like just a lambda, so it's just an anonymous function. But I mean, we've talked about policies and service objects in the past, and all this is doing is it's basically like you can pass around this failure policy, this like anonymous function, to other methods. So like if you happen to rescue in it, it like captures the state of the error, and now you have like, I don't know. Now I'm just sort of like talking out of my ass, but
no, this is my understanding of the caller supplied fallback strategy. It's kind of what you're saying. And I think maybe both of our half's understandings will make a whole understanding for the listener. I love that. Like, we both hoped the other would understand this better, but okay. So what I see here is calling a method and passing in what failure policy you want to use when calling that method. And it's a really interesting idea, so that you can basically say, I can call this method in different ways and pass different failure policies or share failure policies between methods. So you're not rewriting the call catch or the raise. You can make consistent raise across different types of methods. This gets really complicated, but I think the overall takeaway that I think is useful and like you can port over to different code bases is most of these languages or frameworks or libraries will allow you to override the error handlers with your own custom augmented or extend the error handler to do some more creative things. So think about like returning a false or returning an exception is not all you have to get back from your errors. you can look into that method or function and see what was going on and then surface it up to another level and handle it in really useful ways. I think that's the main takeaway here with both, you know, whether it be caller supplied fallback strategy or this multiple return values concept. The other concept that I really, really loved in this chapter, and it's one that I'm thinking of taking away into a code base, was create a process as an object. And this took me a second to get my head around. I kind of reread this section. And so it talked about creating an object that's a download provisionment object that handles the logic of a download. But what that allows you to do is you can wrap a process into an object that's queryable and has its own set of errors against it that makes a ton of sense. So let's say like you create a download provisionment model and a download provisionment object. You can call download provisionment.new.start. You can get its state while it's in process. And it's like, it's totally rocking my world. And do you remember when we were talking about that idea of my web app having a messaging interface in the web app, but it's also interfacing with SMS? And we kind of, the app allows you to get in the state. If there's an invalid phone number or if there's an issue with Twilio, you can get in a state where an object has been created on your screen, but actually didn't send via SMS.
Yeah, you dealing had that, with bug, that state. Yeah, you had that bug a couple
weeks ago. Yeah, there was that bug. I think it would really simplify things if there was a message send object, because I could go message send.new or like somehow wrap that whole process of creating those multiple things into a single object, which looks a lot like a service object, but it's different because it's a process and you think about it in a different way. Like there's a state that has not begun, a state of begun, has a state of in process, and then an error state if it doesn't actually end. And in this case, it's like it would have a state of not begun, and then begun, it's created the database object, and then it's done the next phase, which is sending out the SMS, and then if there's an error at that point, it can handle it accordingly. And it's similar to what we were talking about with wrapping it in a service object, but treating it like a process is really, really interesting, especially for something like a download, an upload, or I can imagine when you're doing some more like advanced JavaScript stuff, like trying to record something, like let's say we're making some kind of screen recorder or audio recorder, wrapping that into an object that handles that recording process would make a ton of sense, like on this subject of error handling and just thinking through the way we could structure that.
Interesting. Okay, let me put you on the spot for a second then. Let's say this process that you're talking about, it successfully creates the database object, and then it tries to go on to the next step of sending a Twilio message. For whatever reason, let's say the API key or something is like wrong, and you get back a, I don't know, a 401 because you're unauthenticated. And then how do you handle that? Like, are you able to like reach into the process and see like what state it's at, and then I don't know what happens?
Yeah, I think you could. I think there's definitely a world that you could. And the way I would think I could handle it is have a column on the message. So I think I would start, so there's basically one database object of a message, and then we're interacting with a service object that is the Twilio service object. So let's say we wrap both those things into this message send object, which is kind of a bad name. Maybe a message sender, message sending, I'm not sure. Message provisioner, let's see, something like that. But let's say it's message send object. I would imagine the first thing I could do is add a database column to the message object that basically holds the confirmation back from Twilio that it was sent. So then it's this three step where I create the message object, I send it via Twilio. If Twilio is successful, then I update that column as being sent or failed otherwise. So it could be a Boolean, a 0-1, a 0 for true, for false, it did not send, and a 1 for true, or it could be a date time. So you could have that state against the message. So this message send process service object would not only create the database object, it would interact with the Twilio API, then fail, then update the message object with that failure state, which then could be rendered in the view. And you could get that little, you know, red dot on it like iMessages would do that says, you know, did not send. Mm-hmm. And then you could even encapsulate that in a resend. And you could re-request the same database object and pass it a message ID into that same message send process object. And so like it gets really powerful if you think about it, abstracting this. I love the idea of putting a process into a RESTful representation. And I've never thought about that in the past. And it brings a lot of these things that are really complicated into the light for me. It gives me a really clear path forward in a lot of different things. But I haven't done it yet, so I'll let you know how it goes. But, you know, I think that could work really well.
Super interesting. I'm getting a little off the rails here, but does it matter? Does it matter if like a message doesn't get sent that it gets sent like right away, or like what if you had a cron that looked at all of the messages and was like, if it failed, just retry it again at like the next day at 9 a.m. or something like that.
Totally. I think there's definitely a use case for a different product that would work. But this specific interface I'm talking about is like a real-time back and forth messaging. So these coaches actually have a very good response time. It's 15 minutes or less. So there's a lot of quasi real-time interaction. Like the messages pop up, it's got a little action cable. So every time there's an inbound, they actually pop up in the thread. So it's quasi real-time SMS. If you think about something more like Airbnb messaging, so it's like, it wouldn't make sense to have it delay a couple hours or 24 hours. And in general, if we have an error sending an SMS, it's generally because there's an issue with the phone number, or that participant has like hard opted out of SMS. Like if they respond with STOP, then like Twilio will no longer let us interact with that user for having a couple issues with now. That's actually something that every single SMS API will do, because by law, if you respond STOP to like all caps to any SMS automated machine, it cannot send you anything else. It's like unsubscribe an email. It's actually by law. So like you can't override that in Twilio at all, which is kind of annoying at times. So you have to be really careful with how you use SMS with your users and not abuse that relationship, obviously. Mm-hmm. But that's obvious to any system. I got way off track.
I mean, I think that sort of like wraps up this section, unless anything else you wanted to bring up.
No, I think it wraps up this little short reader. So it's only a 3-episode arc here. We kind of did a shorter reader as well. And I got a lot out of it. And it makes me just think way less golden path what I'm building. Mm-hmm. Like oftentimes now when I'm writing tests, I'm starting with those error states. And then there's just all sorts of good nuggets in these last 2 episodes for thinking that way and building. I'm trying to remember the actual like the subtext of the book of Exceptional Reread. And I'm going to look that up real quick because it was so good.
Cool. Yeah. And definitely like, I think Minitest has like assert catch or something like that. Like you can actually test that you're raising, or I think it's assert raise. Yeah. Like you can assert raise and then pass in like standard error and then make sure that like given some parameters hitting some endpoint will raise that standard error or whatever it is. And I think like it's really easy to not think of those situations. It's not even so much of like off golden path, because like there's golden path, there's edge cases, there's the opposite of golden path, and then there's also like what happens when you fail. I think it's like its own category, and I think this book really brought to light that you should be thinking about how things fail, especially if you're not just making like a little kitty app and you're actually like interfacing with a ton of external services. You're definitely going to want to think about like what happens in a real world scenario where I have to like ping a different API and maybe I want to retry because like the connection's shoddy. It's not even that like the request failed. It's just that like maybe the connection's not so good. And so that's something that you want to retry like 5 times or 6 times or 7 times. Just thinking about that has made me like, I don't know, has like opened my eyes a little bit more into thinking about how you should be interacting with external services and how you should be thinking about failure.
Yeah, that's a good distinction between like golden path and failure, and designing with failure in mind is really the intent of this book. And we kind of covered some of the other things as well, but it's a really useful hat to wear. Like what will happen if this fails? How can we recover that state? Do we need to retry? What does that look like? So yeah, great read. Awesome stuff. So you want to jump into picks? What do you got for us, JP?
Dude, you mentioned you were working on some React Native stuff. So guess what? I'm hooking you up, dog, with a ton of React Native. I have 3 picks for React Native. And there's like,
oh, I'm ready. 3 React Native picks. Let's go.
Okay. The first two are kind of similar. They are, one of them's called React Native Motion, and one of them's called Fluid Transitions. I have links in this README. And what they do is they let you have shared element transitions. So Airbnb used to do this, but I think they ripped it out because of like maybe like performance or I don't know. But if you remember the demo that I sent you, it was using shared element transitions. And I think that the Apple App Store uses shared element transitions. So what
Shared element transition. Talk us through this, because it's like I'm so jealous of it as a web dev, and it's just something you just can't really do on web with any kind of performance.
Yeah, I think you can like kind of fake it with CSS if you're like very clever.
But, yeah, you have to be really clever though. So what is it? You're keeping us in suspense.
Yeah, it's very hard to describe, but I'm just going to describe an interaction and maybe that will suffice for our listeners. So imagine you are on Airbnb and you have a bunch of property cards. You can like tap into a property card and that property card will then like zoom in and then become the page. So whereas like a normal mobile app transition might just like slide over the whole screen, the element that you're tapping or the element that is transitioning is shared because it becomes part of the next screen. I don't know. It's very hard.
Yeah, you did pretty good. I'll say one thing. So,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you have a card with like an image on the card. You touch the card with the image and that image just grows to be the hero of the next screen.
Yes.
That's the most common way that they do these
shared element transitions. Because like from page to page.
Shared element transitions. That's
okay.
Right.
There's two pages and between those, they share an element. And that element transitions onto the next
page. It's so cool. It's like one of my favorite design things that's happened in the last year or two. And the first place I ever saw it was Airbnb. And the Apple App Store app does it really, really well too in the home feed. I can actually just play with that because it's so pretty. And they always pick such nice images and design with it. Yeah. So these libraries help you do that in React Native? Is that what the...
Yes. So the problem with shared element transitions is that they fundamentally shift the paradigm in how you navigate through an app. So you typically, if you're doing like a React Native app, you'll have a navigation library. Maybe it's React Native Navigation. Maybe it's React Navigation. Maybe it's React Native Router Flux. There's a ton of them. But the one that like Facebook, like not sponsors or recommends, but like that's like the de facto is React Navigation. And this fluid transitions library actually plays nicely-ish with React Navigation. So typically in the navigation world, you'll have either like a stack navigator or a tab navigator. And those are exactly what they sound like. A stack navigator, you can push onto the stack. You can slide screens onto a stack. Tab navigator is like when you see those tabs at the bottom of a screen and you can like sort of tab through them. I think there's
and then there's combinations of those as well. Right. Like you can have a tab navigation with a stack inside. And that's oftentimes what you see. Like the bottom tabs go to a couple different stacks. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So fluid transitions, I think, has something called like a fluid navigator. And so like you define a shared element between the two screens and it will like do what you want between them.
Wow, that's really cool.
It's very
awesome pick. Okay, what are the other couple picks you've got?
Okay, so two of
or
them
are those
had to
all
do with,
the same one? Okay.
Yeah, two of them had to do with animation stuff, and the last one is called React Native Testing Library, which you had mentioned earlier in this episode that you brought into like a framework for testing. And so React Native Testing Library is cool because it basically wraps an API around the React Native or React Test Renderer. And it's like inspired by Kent Dodds's React testing library, which I like think is amazing. And I probably have picked that before. But if you look at the readme of this thing, it makes it like really easy to grab elements. It's not the DOM, but it lets you grab elements from the screen and make assertions on those elements. And also like you can like grab a button and fire an event and make sure that event gets called with like this, like certain parameters, which I think is like kind of a different way of testing than you're used to with something like a mini test or an RSpec or a capybara. But I think you would be able to ship code more confidently if you test your React Native applications like this.
Cool. Okay, I don't know if I've picked this before. I would like to pick Slack screen video calls. Have you done Slack video calls?
I have, yeah. It's like I've paired with coworkers that way before. It's kind of
yeah, cute. Okay. I didn't even know this existed, that you can share keyboard and mouse control within Slack, and it works really, really well. And you can like draw on each other's screen. And like for our agency and the work that we're doing, we're not using any. We used to use like a peer in and Google Hangouts and stuff, and we only use the built-in Slack one. And it's just super slick. So if you haven't given that a shot, or like your company or your crew is like using multiple tools, like I don't know, give it a shot, because it's pretty awesome to be able to share keyboard and mouse control and like draw on the screen, and it's pretty performant, works on the mobile just fine, and I'm super happy with it. So that's kind of my quasi weird little pick.
Nice. Cool. Should we wrap up?
Yeah, let's wrap up. Well, thanks so much for listening. We will see you guys in about 2 weeks with a brand new book. If you'd like to support the show, the best place to go is iteration.tools. And on there, you'll see a collection of links that are some useful tools, learning tools, some different vendors that we both use and love. And if you purchase through there, then it actually supports the show and raises some money for us. So we would appreciate that. And in the meantime, go build the future, and we'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Thanks so much for listening.